welcome to Michigan HockeyCast 4.20, where we will try not to lose any accessories under the Zamboni. As you well know, hockey is played on ice. We've talked about this many of times. One sport that is not played on ice is baseball, at least until Friday. Did you see any of or the highlights or anything of Michigan's baseball game against Louisville on Friday that took place in the middle of a snow globe?
No, I only saw the whatever you call it, the screenshots that were being sent around.
Well,
I think Chris Federer posted one. So,
hey, he's still connected. Maybe he'll come back and be our pitching coach again. I think we could use him. Anyway, so they play the first game at like 1. They move it up. It's supposed to be like, I think, 3 and 7 or something. They play the first game at 1, and it goes off without a hitch, and Michigan loses 5-3 to a probably pretty good Louisville team. And then the second game starts right afterwards because snow is coming and they're trying to get the games in, and they've already scheduled that there will not be a game on Saturday, hence the doubleheader on Friday. And within an inning or two, it is just pouring down snow, and it is driving like parallel to the ground. Like there were multiple missed balls in the outfield. It's like what you dream about watching a football game that you don't care about in, like that's the kind of weather are you the one that said all soccer should be played in those kinds of conditions?
I think I did say that at one point.
It sounds like a drainism, but I mean, multiple fly balls. There were at least 3 pitches that went into like the stands before the game was finally called in the 5th inning. It was just, it was an experience to behold.
Sounds like you're describing the weather conditions of the Michigan-Ohio State game from last fall.
Hey, well, Michigan ended up winning both of them, actually, because the game was finally postponed in the 5th inning. And after Michigan scored 10 runs due to a bunch of errors and mishaps, as you can imagine, in that kind of environment, they ended up winning the completion of the game on Sunday and then dropping the final game. So they only win 1 of 3 in Louisville. But it was an interesting note, baseball in the snow. I've played, you know, plenty of different sports in my life in random conditions, but I don't think I've ever done baseball in the snow. Do you have a crazy in-person sports story that took place in an environment it definitely should not have? Like when you used to do, forensics, right? You used to do forensics.
Yeah, we never did outdoors. That's
but
not
did
how
you
that
ever,
works.
Did you ever do it like with a fire alarm going off? Cause that would be probably the equivalent.
No, I had, one round that was in like a broom closet, but
were you locked in it?
It was a little odd. But otherwise, no, I did the Michigan softball Big Ten tournament game against MSU in 2018 in Madison. That was like 38 degrees and a light drizzle throughout the game. That was pretty bad.
But could you hear your teeth chattering on the broadcast?
No, but my feet were basically, you know, had to be sawed off.
Frozen to the spot.
Yeah. Lost all, you know, nerve damage, etc. But anyway, those are about it. Otherwise, the cold games I've ever been to are really like outdoor hockey games, that sort of thing. But
kind
of par for the course. So
I mean, outdoor games at that time of year tend to
Did
get
you
that
see
way.
The Heritage Classic yesterday?
I had it on. I watched the end. I watched some of the beginning. I think I had dinner in between, but
Wayne
I watched
Gretzky,
parts of it.
Gretzky was very cold. He just kept complaining about that, and then they brought him inside into the booth.
So they just had him outside? Like
well,
you at Michigan
and,
State.
Well, him and Keith Jones were supposed to be the sideline reporters, and Keith Jones stayed out there, but he had to come inside.
I heard it was just him telling stories, and no one was talking about the game.
That's basically what it was. I mean, they made a big deal because Hamilton is, you know, about 25 minutes from Brantford, which is Gretzky's hometown and everything. So they decided to kind of make it into that. But some of the stories were kind of interesting. Some were a little odd, but
it feels like TNT is like desperate to create a hockey version of like the Barclay Shaq Kenny crew, and like Wayne Gretzky is their feature head. I mean,
which is a little problematic because Wayne Gretzky is just not that interesting of a person.
I was going to say he doesn't really have that much personality, does he? I mean,
no.
I'm sure he's smart and he can articulate things, but I mean, you also need to be interesting to be on the air, which means we probably are interesting because we're still on the air, at least at a lower level. Minor league hockey podcasts. Anyway, the only other thing I have, is there anything else you wanted to talk about in the Heritage Classic or the,
no, like, I'm not getting into the suspension roulette conversation that's been dominating the internet.
Oh, today. That's right. Is that, I assume you've been partaking in the discourse.
I'm not, partaking in any discourse about this. I view suspensions in the NHL the same way I view targeting in the
number college, from a bag
in the college football. Yes. Yeah. It's like how anytime there's a targeting review in the Michigan game, I just now tweet, don't ask me.
Okay. The only other thing of note, which before we get into the game, is something that happened during the intermission. The Zamboni finally ran over a shoe. So like for years, I mean, like back when I was in school, we would even yell, you know, throw your shoe at like the little kid on the Zamboni as he rides around. And usually most of them would. Now it's gotten to the point of where if you don't, you basically get booed because it's just a tradition of like when you get on the thing, you throw your shoe and then you throw your sock. And the one girl even like tried to take her shirt off and everyone's like, no, no, freaking out. And that was a little probably too far. But apparently this was like a big shoe and it came from the stands. And then the Zamboni ran over it and it got stuck, and someone in one of the comments of my breakdown said that like ice chips came shooting out the side of the Zamboni, like on the bottom, because apparently the shoe was lodged somewhere. I wish I knew the end of this story. Hopefully someone will chime in and put this in a comment or email one of us or something. But because you've seen that, right, at Yost, where they throw the socks and the shoes and all that.
Yeah, I don't remember the shoe getting run over, but I was down on the concourse throwing punches for chicken tenders.
at Jim Harbaugh's children?
Yeah, I ran into Harbaugh and his children on the way down the staircase. He was on the suites level, and the press is above that, so same staircase. He was lassoing about 10 children, all like under the age of 8 or something, walking to the concourse. So that was kind of interesting. But second note I just want to throw out here, we got some breaking news.
Uh-oh.
That we'll be breaking right now on this show. College Hockey News has just published that Lindenwood University in St. Charles, Missouri, is going to be starting a D1 hockey program, possibly as soon as next fall. So there could be getting us back to 60 teams in Division One.
Is that, are they going to be in a conference?
Well, actually, no, they would be 61 because there's another school starting next year. Remember, Augustana University in South Dakota is starting a team. So,
man, they're going like full Atlantic hockey with names that don't reside in or aren't alluding to specific states. So now you're like, oh, where's this? Oh, I don't know. Where's St. Thomas? Long Island. Oh, well, I have a guess on Long Island, but.
They would not be joining a conference. There will be 6 independents next season. Arizona State, Alaska, LIU, Anchorage, which is coming back, Lindenwood,
what?
And
they're coming back?
Yeah, they're on hiatus. They're not gone for good. They were just waiting for money, and I guess they've gotten the money. So it'd be, yeah, 6 independents. Lindenwood and Augustana would be the 2 new ones.
Sounds like a conference to me. Just take all 7 schools from all 4 corners of the U.S. and put them in one conference. Because, you know, college hockey can afford that, right?
Yeah. I mean, Lindenwood, I think they might be on Ohio State's non-conference schedule next year.
Really?
Well, they might lose to them just like they lost to Bentley. Had to get that one on the show.
Yeah, I was a little bummed when Bentley lost in their conference tournament this weekend. I was like, hey, you guys did a good job this year, though. I'm proud of you. So that is more from Section 2. We'll go through conference tournaments wide and pairwise and that sort of thing and how all those things played out. But first, we will talk about what you're tuning in for, hopefully. Maybe it's just Alex and my enjoying banter about random stuff, which you always get for the first few minutes. But Michigan hockey has arguably their biggest win of the year. I think that the Minnesota State game is in contention. Probably one of those Minnesota games is also in there. But from like a 1,000-foot view, this win was probably as well played a game as they had played start to finish all year.
Yeah, I would say it's right up there with, I mean, probably one of the, probably the Minnesota State game and then maybe the second Ohio State game. But yeah, I mean, this was a really good showing. And I think the first thing to talk about is what the part of my column that just went up on the site today on Monday. So
you mean 2 days ago?
Yeah, whatever. Again, we don't exist.
We don't have days.
We have time. We don't have time. anyway, I was focusing in that piece on energy level with the team, because you could tell right from the jump that Michigan's energy level in this game was a lot higher than it had been in any of the previous Notre Dame games. They came out hot right from the beginning and were just locked in, and were executing at a higher level, were competing at a higher level. They were winning so many more puck battles. And the thing about energy level, and I talk about this in the piece, is that it's really crucial to hockey. And it's why when you hear coaches behind the bench, they're never, when you know, they're mic'd up, that sort of thing. It's not a situation where they've got the whiteboard out unless it's a late game situation.
Or like a face-off play or something. Yeah.
Otherwise, they're always yelling about energy, right? If a team is struggling, the coach is not saying we need to do this X's and O's things. They're saying, you know, we need to get our legs, you know, get out there, compete, fight, that sort of thing, right? Like that's what they bark behind the bench whenever you hear those things. And that's how it is, because in the course of a game, the energy levels rise and they fall, right? One team gets a power play, then they feed off that for a few minutes, then the other team comes back. But Michigan really had the energy advantage almost the entire game. I think Notre Dame got it to a draw in the second period, and then Michigan rose the energy level right back up for the third period. And you know, that I think is the central sort of storyline. And to me, it seems pretty clear that their energy came from that they wanted this game really badly. And you don't celebrate the way they celebrated in a semifinal game unless you really wanted this game. So I think that's the underscore, right? The subplot for this game.
Yeah, and I mean, those were the first like three notes that I have written down for the first period, is just like good shifts, controlling play. They kept Notre Dame in their own end. They're winning battles. I mean, you were sitting next to me, but we were talking about how they're winning battles on the boards and in the neutral zone. They're not trying to skate through everybody. I mean, like that was what part of their faltering in the series in South Bend was, you have a guy like, all right, I'll just stick handle through two or three guys in the neutral zone. And when you're playing Michigan State, you might be able to do that. Not really the case with Notre Dame. And that's not what they were doing. They would, if they wasn't there, they'd circle back and you'd see like Pearson to Power across the pass. And then the center cuts the other side. They try to go in that way. And it's not just like forcing it. They're making smart plays. And then they're like out dueling guys on the boards, because eventually they had a kind of a bad defensive zone turnover, I would say probably at least halfway into the first period, and Portillo had to come out and make a big save. And you kind of looked at me and you're like, well, that's the first time they really lost a battle on the boards.
Yeah, they really, Notre Dame had one chance in the first period, and it was a really good pass, by the way, from the wall to the slot. And that was kind of the story of the game. Any chances Notre Dame got were either off of good bounces or just really, really good passing plays. And otherwise, Michigan was dominant. I mean, they gave up, what, maybe four shots in the first period?
Four
and
shots.
Very, you know, maybe six shot attempts total. And that was the only good one, was the one right to the slot. And Portillo was right there. He made the save. And otherwise, it was all Michigan in that first period.
Yeah, and you know, I also have written down that KJ had a really nice play. He kind of walked in and fired wide, and then Brisson was right behind him. So they went back to the hero line with, you know, because we talked about that sort of at the beginning of the semester or the second half of the season, and they got away from it, obviously, as players went to the Olympics. And then going into Notre Dame, they brought it back for the first game. And it didn't really take. It didn't work super well. And they split them back into the, you know, B&B pair and the KJ and Beniers pair. And now we're going to try again the top line. And it was as dominant as ever. And We talked about what the best way to run these lines are, and I think that this is, if you're going to get what you're getting from the Beecher line, and Estapa and Pasta have their roles with Bortolo, and he can and that can create a little bit on their own. Then putting those three guys on the top line, I mean, it's just going to be really hard for other teams to match up.
Yeah, and it was a big game for this line that was put together again, Johnson and Beniers with Brisson, because they were invisible the first series against Notre Dame. I mean, unquestionably, not the first series, the second series, but the
Well,
ones
yeah,
that
but
won after they came back from the Olympics. I mean, really poor weekend for them in that series, not driving play at all. And they came out and had a really good first period and just continued it all game long. And they, I think, earned the right to stay together the next weekend against Minnesota.
yeah, and as long as I think that doesn't go super poorly like it did a few weeks ago, I feel like, or there's an injury or something, that seems like the future of the remaining, hopefully, five games for this team is with those guys out front, and then it's not even that much of a drop. I mean, the amount, I mean, that's the other thing is like the Beecher and the freshman line, I thought were not as effective in terms of like the high danger chances, but they still got a number of chances. They were still also carrying play and getting shots to the net. And like that was sort of the thing in that separates Michigan obviously this year from previous years is just like now their depth is so good that when their first line is able to click, it just, I mean, I don't even know. You just have to hope that your second and third defensive pairings can hold up because if they can't, I mean, Michigan can come at you in waves.
Yeah, Michigan is just a really, really deep team if they can get that top line rolling. And the thing about the Beecher line this game, I mean, it wasn't generating a ton of chances, but they were really strong defensively. I thought Sam Moskevich was good defensively. And I thought, Beecher, this was something we talked about after the Notre Dame series last time around, that the Beecher suspension, ejection rather, was bad because he was a player that Michigan needed to play that kind of game physically. And I think that was really clear in this game. He had the thundering hit at center ice. I think that was in the second period. But right from the jump, I mean, Michigan as a whole, from the jump, everybody was finishing their checks. That was clear a minute in. But Beecher in particular had maybe five or six hits in this game, just flying around the ice and bodying people. And Michigan seemed much more comfortable to play this sort of physical game and kind of go into the mud with their opposition. So that line, I think, set the tempo for that sort of game.
Yeah, I agree. That makes a lot of sense. The last thing in the first period is the power play. And I say the power play is because there was only one power. I mean, I guess technically it was two because Michigan ended up getting a 5-on-3, but the only man advantage for either team came near the end of the first period. And Power gets cross-checked in the net. And you had mentioned to me, a really nice entry, gets to the net, looks like he's going to have a rebound or a tap in, and just gets walloped in the back and goes flying into the net or around the net. And that's easily called. But you had mentioned to me that probably saves a goal given like the position that he was in. And then right into Michigan's power play, KJ's tripped as he's trying to get to the boards to retrieve the puck. And I think Michigan had a 5-on-3 for a little over 90 seconds. I mean, this was going to be an extended power play.
Yeah, I mean, they get a 5-on-3, and then it doesn't go great.
Well, it's up and down, right? Like, I mean, they threw a couple passes out of the zone that they
Yeah,
had to retrieve.
right off the bat.
And
Beniers, I think, mishandled it along the wall.
you said that at one point a guy went off the ice to change and no one came on the ice, and so they took a 5-on-3 and made it a 4-on-3 for
It was about
too many
10.
seconds.
It was about 10 seconds. I went back and rewatched it today. It felt longer in real time, but
Yeah, as things do.
it was about 10 seconds of game time looking back. And credit to whoever was the color guy on the broadcast. He picked it out too. But people watching it on TV didn't seem to notice because no one was tweeting about it. I was the only one tweeting about it.
Well, and that's not always something that's easy to see depending on the camera angles. And I mean, we're privy to that because our next move. So, so they set up in the X formation, which I like. There were some arguments given to me on Twitter, and I was talking to a couple people in the box, and they were, you know, not 100% sure about it. But I thought they got good chances. Galida, I had down making two really good saves. And then they finally got the puck to Brisson on his dot, and he was wide open, and he hits the crossbar. So, I mean, you always want to put one of those in, but when you waste time by not having the right number of people on the ice, and you throw passes, plural, out of the zone that you have to retrieve, and you still get three really good chances, you know, it's not the worst. I'm not, you know, we've talked about this structure a few times, and I personally like it. And when you make the defenseman have to turn all the way around and go 360 degrees, if someone isn't making the right read and following the puck for even an instant and goes the wrong way, I mean, you have just a wide open look. And when you have to basically defend all sides of your body, that's difficult.
I don't hate the structure of it. I think if they just had gotten a little more time, you could have gotten another look or two, but yeah. A lot of errors, shall we say, in that sequence. And frankly, that 5-on-3 was probably the most mistake-heavy period of the entire game.
Yes. From mistake standpoints, I would agree with you. And they still almost scored. I mean, they hit the crossbar. So, yeah. And then that was most of the first period. Brisson actually hit the bar later. Oh, no, that was the same one, yeah. So, into the second period, and this is where it got a little crazy, because you have Michigan sort of overwhelming Notre Dame in the first period, but Galida making saves and Michigan not able to capitalize. And then the second period, both teams sort of exploded with chances. And like, you thought that Notre Dame's energy was up a little bit.
Well, it was up after Michigan got the goal, because right. Michigan dominates the first 3 or 4 minutes, and then they get the goal, and then after that, Notre Dame starts to really wake up.
Yeah, and the goal is really, I mean, as well worked as we've seen one this year, it ends up being a 4-on-3, which is not necessarily the fault of, you know, defensemen per se on Notre Dame, but you just have, you know, Michigan's defensemen are very prone to join rushes, and they get the fourth guy in, Brisson and Bernier, or KJ enters, but then he hits Beniers, and then you get a nice pass across to Brisson, who gives it right back through the slot. Both these passes go through the slot, and Galida has to go with the puck, and it looks like a Brisson shot, but he returns it to Beniers, and it's just an empty net, easy layup.
It was the skating of Kent Johnson through the neutral zone that started that play going. I did think that Jake Boltman, number 6 for Notre Dame, kind of got roasted on that play. He didn't really do anything. He tried, but his attempts did not work to stop either the pass from Beniers to Brisson or the pass back. He starts to try to break up the first pass, then he fails at that, so he turns around. He's too late to get the return feed, and so that's the one person at fault, if you would pick out anybody. And it's not very often you can get a breakdown from Notre Dame close in at the net, and it took Michigan making some really high-danger passes to get that breakdown to happen.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. They right after that, Michigan also gets a couple more chances too, because you have Ethan Edwards, I thought, had another strong game, but his speed showed up a lot, even on exits and everything, and he got a chance that actually went right down the middle of the ice, splitting both Notre Dame defensemen, and got a poke shot on the net that was probably not going in, but it was a lot more dangerous than initially I thought it was going to be. And Galida made another save, and he also made a save on Estapa in tight as Estapa got behind Notre Dame's defense. And so Michigan had chances even to make it a 2-1 game, but we're not able to do so, at least, or 2-0 game. And, you know, those are the kinds that, like, we talked about this, like getting the first goal. Michigan gets the first goal against Notre Dame. You get two goals against Notre Dame, which actually, ironically, they had in both games at Yost, and you feel really confident. And right. This team, the way they were skating, it would have felt borderline like the game's over if they would have gotten one of those second ones.
Yeah, definitely, in the way they were playing.
But they do not, and Notre Dame responds really well, because they realize that they're on the verge of, you know, being well, they are being outplayed. Goliath is definitely keeping them in the game, and it's time for them to respond. And they do on getting multiple shots on Portillo. He made a phenomenal left pad reach save where he just gets his skate and pad to the post. Our photographer James Collar got a perfect shot of this, and that's the thing that I think Portillo has improved on over the years. Obviously, he's been really good making positional saves, and he's great playing the puck and moving it along, but it's sort of the athletic stuff and the moving of his mountain-sized human being from one side to another, and he looked, I thought, really strong there, making a couple saves before Notre Dame eventually tied it.
Well, and that save was really just about side-to-side agility, because Notre Dame's guy is falling over. He's not able to get the puck up off the ice. So all Portillo really had to do was just get over, and he was able to do that. He's pretty quick in his crease despite the size. And that whole play was just a goofy one, because it's on the wall, then it kicks out to the middle, then the guy sort of, it's rolling past a Michigan defenseman, then the first shot is just whacked at and it flutters off the Michigan defenseman right back to the guy. Then he just sends the knuckleball at the you know, the net, and then it takes a perfect bounce out, and it's just like, man, oh man. I did tweet this today when I was doing my research earlier, but Michigan is tied for fifth in the country in fewest goals allowed per game.
Yeah, well, I mean,
feels like a testament to Eric Portillo.
Well, I mean, the one issue that we had, one of the two issues maybe that we had in the first half of the season, was their defense at times could get sloppy, not just in like giving up odd man rushes where you're taking chances, but in zone stuff. They'd lose guys from time to time, or wouldn't be checked, or you just wouldn't play great positional hockey, at least when they didn't have the puck. And I mean, there have been very few games where that has not happened. They've gotten burned a couple of times on them, but for goals, and ended up losing a game here or there. But there have just been very few games where they have played bad positional defense on top of the Portillo goaltending, basically in 2022.
Pretty much. Occasional breakdowns here and there, but otherwise it's been pretty strong.
Which, that stuff's going to happen, right? I mean, like, you're
it's going to happen. I would have liked fewer in the Notre Dame series, but that's really the only one that we're throwing, you know, hands about. So,
yeah, and there's a bit that we didn't like about that series for Michigan, but so Notre Dame does end up tying it on maybe the most absurd pass we've seen this year, as Karashek is behind the net and is being checked. I mean, it's not like no one is around him, but he's able to get a pass off into the slot to Jack Adams, who has a guy on either side of him, but his pass just like hits him in the tape, and it didn't even necessarily look like a full-on shot. It was more of like a redirect, sort of like half bunt check chip, maybe something, because he gets the puck in the air and it goes over Portillo and under the bar where you want it, honestly, against Portillo. But you know, if that pass isn't right there where it needs to be, this puck probably isn't really even on net.
It's a perfect pass, and it's another you know, luck-based bounce situation. The play starts, it's in the corner, Triscott's going up the wall with it, and it hits a referee. And that begins a long extended cycle play. And it's worth pointing that out simply because Michigan's exits were so crisp all day long.
Yeah.
I mean, Michigan conversion rate on zone exits and clears was close to 100%. And it was a pretty easy clear attempt right there. And the referee's in the way, and it begins this cycle play. And then again, it's just the few chances they got were combinations of lucky bounces or great passes. And this one was both. It's bounce, start the play, and then just a tremendous pass from Karashek. I mean, cause slides down the wall. Michigan's got a guy on him. They've got 2-3 bodies in the slot. It's, you know, it's like throwing a 50-yard touchdown pass right into a tiny window where the cornerback is wearing the receiver like a cheap suit, and you manage to just fit it in there. I mean, it's just perfect, perfect pass, the right shot, and there's not a whole lot you can do about that. So my honest thought after that was just Michigan needs to just keep attacking and keep playing the game, because they didn't really do anything wrong on that goal, and sometimes that happens.
Yeah, I mean, that was the thing, is we watched the replay and who's this on? Should Portillo have saved it? Not really. Is it the guy that's checking the one? No. Is it the two guys in the slot? No. I mean, you're just going one by one. No, this guy's doing everything he can. And, you know, the puck just went in, and, you know, it just kind of had that feeling of like, come on, like Michigan's outplayed them for a game and a half. They've brought the energy, something they didn't have. They've like executed really well. They're playing with speed, you know, something that they probably have more of than Notre Dame. So all the things you're doing and still getting towards, you know, the end of the second period now, and it's still tied. And you're just like, you know, is anything at some point we got to get some bounce, some break, because, you know, Notre Dame is able to stay in these games with Michigan, despite even now in this case, Michigan outplaying them, outskating them, out battling them. I mean, they're out battling Notre Dame and they're not winning a game, which is, I mean, I don't even know what to say about that. But and then, you know, Notre Dame looks like they're even going to take the lead, because you get this 2-on-1 on this flip pass that goes up and over basically the neutral zone, and Michigan's caught in a bad change, and Portillo has to make an extended save as the guy walks right in on him, and then he ends up covering it, and then Portillo makes an or another nice extended toe save. So he's had plural sort of extension leg pad feet saves that just kind of, he's just kind of the cherry and the whipped cream on top of this team, because when you do, when everyone does everything well, and then on top of that, you get really good goaltending. I mean, we talked about how great Strauss Mann is, and Brian's a big fan. I was, I mean, everyone liked him, but I mean, Portillo, and you've mentioned this, this was your thing, that like Portillo is starting to get pretty close to matching his numbers.
I think his save percentage is still at 929 after the weekend, but Strauss's was at 930 last year. And I think, frankly, Strauss had better defense in front of him for more of the year.
More of the year, yeah.
He did, yeah.
So, I mean, that's just, I mean, that was the point where Michigan is completely outplaying Notre Dame, but Eric Portillo is still saving the day at times for them.
I mean, that's how it is, right? You talk about, what do you need to win a championship? Even you look at the teams that are just really good and really dominant. And I'm not like Chris Osgood booster or something. I'm also not really a Chris Osgood hater. He was a fine goalie, not a superstar. But when he did win his Stanley Cups, you know, he would still come up with the one or two big saves you need. I mean, those Red Wings teams were so dominant, controlled play at such a high level, but it's playoff hockey. You still, to win games close against great teams, you're going to give up a few chances, and you do need a goalie to step up. And they don't have to be saving the game. They don't have to be stealing the game, but you're going to concede a few A-plus chances, and you need the goalies to make a high percentage of those. And Portillo's done that most games of the entire season.
Agree completely. Finally, Michigan is able to get their lead back on just another complete play by multiple guys on the ice. The puck is kind of coming up the zone, and Truscott up the boards on the far side from us. And Truscott steps in to pinch in to keep the puck in the zone. He ends up winning the battle, ends up taking actually the guy in the puck back around behind the net before dumping it off to Beniers, who skates out in front, hits Brisson, who takes a stride or two into the slot and rips a shot inside the far post, and it beats Galida. And this is sort of the bounce that they get, right? Is that it's, we looked at this about three times on the replay, and you can see the puck flutter a little bit. It looked like it was deflected off of the defenseman, but you know, that's the thing. I mean, we talked about, when you block shots, sometimes the puck goes in. When you get good opportunities, sometimes you can beat somebody. I mean, Michigan piled up their A-plus chances in this game. It wasn't an overwhelming amount, but it was enough to get a couple goals. And this one went in because they did all the right things, and you powered his shot through.
Yeah, so this play is interesting because it starts with Jacob Truscott coming down the wall on the hard pinch, which was also interesting because Michigan hadn't had that much in the third period. That was I was watching that specifically in the early third period. Michigan, every time they had a chance to pinch hard and keep a cycle possession going, they weren't doing it. Their defensemen were falling back. They were very conservative on that. They didn't want to give up rushes. So that was the first time in the 3.5 minutes to start that third period that you had a defenseman slide hard down the wall. And he does a really good job with it. He ties up his guy, eventually gets it himself with help, I think, from Beniers. Might have been Johnson, but somebody else there goes down into the corner, again gets kind of tied up, but still manages to kick it forward. And that really creates the pass then from Beniers to Brisson in the slot. And I still don't know if this was deflected. I think it was. And there's two factors here. Galida, there's definitely a screen going on here where the defenseman is blocking Galida's view of it. But Galida,
the guy who's checking Brisson.
Yes. Well, the and Galida goes kind of like the opposite, you know, direction of where it's going, right? Goleta slides to his left, to our right, and the shot goes in the other direction. And normally when you see the goaltender slide one way, but it go in the other side, it's a deflection. That was my initial thought in watching it. When you do see the replay, the puck is kind of wobbling, which is also a sign of a slight deflection. But I'm not sure. It might have just been a good shot that was just a little wobbly off the tape. Not, you know, can't really tell. But the screen of the goalie either had him going the wrong way or it deflected it or both. Either way, you know, shot through traffic, which is kind of what we said was the whole thing about Notre Dame. Even if you have a guy facing you up, you need to still try and put pucks on net.
And they did. And like, it was still early in the third, and so there's a lot of game to be played, but you just sort of felt like, one, the way Michigan's been playing, if they can continue that, Notre Dame is going to struggle to really get a lot of chances, and they're going to need, you know, like you said, a save or two from Portillo. But you just felt very good about it at that point. And, you know, obviously I get a third, you want the distance, but it seemed like that had a really good chance of being the winner, the way the game was going. One of Notre Dame's biggest chances actually came not too long after that, though, is there was a scramble in front and Portillo ended up making a huge save. I don't really remember how he even made it. It was kind of a scrum and the puck comes loose and he ends up getting in front of it. And I mean, you can just hear like the exhale from Yost as it just, like, because to give the lead away like that for the third game in a row at Yost against Notre Dame would just have been like a crusher. And then they end up getting a 2-on-1 going back the other way right out of that. You got Beecher and Samo going the other way, but then Notre Dame steps up with a back check. So they don't even get a shot off on it. Like, this was something that doesn't really fit in one for specific area of the timeline, but Michigan ended up getting like 5 odd man rushes in this game. Like, they scored on the one, had a couple other 4-on-3s, had this 2-on-1, but there are a couple times where they didn't even get shots off on them. I mean, Notre Dame did a good job getting back even to challenge this one. Michigan gets a 3-on-1 later that it just seemed like there were too many guys. And, but that's interesting a little bit to me because, you know, they didn't get any in South Bend.
No, I mean, you know, overall, I think when you look at this game, the Michigan defense was fantastic and Michigan's offense was fantastic. I mean, this is just a total team effort. And what I think is notable about that link, remember the Saturday game in South Bend? Remember how tight Michigan came out? They were not getting the offensive chances that they had early in the Friday game because you could just tell they were content to play Notre Dame's game because they were so paranoid about making the really bad mistake.
Yeah.
They didn't get quality looks. They kept falling the defenseman back, just playing really just, you know, we'll get it across center and we'll dump it in. We'll go for a change. Then we'll just trap. You know, it was like the Devil's Stars 2000 Stanley Cup final. Right? Like, we're just not, neither of us are going to try at offense. So we're just going to sit back and hope neither of us make a mistake. And that's not what they did this time. They didn't play tight. They didn't play Notre Dame's game. They continued to attack offensively, and they played really good defense. And they did it through dominant puck possession, controlling shot attempts, and overall through just playing their game with a high compete level. And that's, you know, comes back to the energy level point I was making earlier.
The next kind of notable thing that happened in this game was we ended up with 4-on-4 because Matty Beniers was checked in the back and went flying. And so there was a penalty on Notre Dame. And then he was given a penalty for embellishment. And I mean, Yost was lit. I mean, they were booing and yelling. I mean, you could hear it. And then on the replay, you look at it and you're like, I mean, just in theory, first of all, you're just, how do you embellish a cross check from the back? Like, you don't even know it's coming. There's no plan. There's no, oh no, it's just like you just get hit in the back and you fall or you don't, you know, whatever happens. He fell in this particular case. And my thought was like, all right, they haven't been calling any penalties. It's getting to be late for Notre Dame. It's 2-1 Michigan. Michigan had the only real power play of the game. And they can't give him another one and not give Notre Dame anyone because it just looks too bad. And so I think they just tried to wipe that one away and maybe extend the game a little longer in certain ways. I mean, that's kind of conspiratorial, but like, did you have any thought that that Beniers was diving on that?
No, not at all. You know, the thing about it is that it's not conspiracy to talk about game management, because that's how it is. We know that, right? That was the Tim Peel controversy last year. We know that's how referees do it in hockey, and they're told to do it that way. However, I do think it's always possible to just keep in mind the incompetence part of it. That's my retort to conspiracy theorists in general, is that, in, you know, when given the choice between grand conspiracy and incompetence, it's almost always incompetence. But I don't know. It was definitely not a dive. It was a hard cross check right in the back. We know Notre Dame does that stuff. They'd already hit him with that earlier in the game. You know, it's frustrating, but the truth is, it's not the worst thing in the world, because you play 4-on-4 and Michigan just played it really conservative, and they were able to just run the 2 minutes out without any issues.
They also had all the chances on 4-on-4.
Yeah, and but they weren't, you know, they were not interested in breaking the game down and doing rushes each way.
But they could play four corners and just kill the 2 minutes, which they were content to do. Yeah. Yeah. And then they actually had a chance to seal it on a 4-on-3 again, because Michigan this time got a little aggressive and jumped the fourth guy in. It was Bersan in this case. He gets hit with a nice pass in the slot, and the puck just jumps the stick, because he has as golden a look as he did, probably better than in the one he scored his goal, and the puck just jumped it. Otherwise, it easily could have ended right there.
Well, and I think that was probably the best chance because of who was on the ice, but their actual best look came a little after that, when they had the 4-on-1 with Lambert, Van Wy, Moyle, and I don't remember who the fourth guy was, but I was rewatching the game earlier today, and you know, I saw that one, and that's when my dad had texted me about shooting the puck in that situation. And it's true, because they get it set up perfectly so that Lambert goes over to Moyle, and he is, I mean, point blank range, no, you know, him and the goalie, nobody else, right in tight at as close as you can get, basically like a shootout almost.
Yeah.
And he passes it back to Lambert, who doesn't have a good look, and the Notre Dame stick comes in and breaks it up. I mean, you just got to shoot there.
Also, as Lambert, why in the world would you ever be expecting that?
Yeah. Shoot the puck.
Yeah. And sort of the last real chance for Notre Dame was, because you'd made a note that in the last 8 minutes, you thought Notre Dame did not get a shot on net.
They had officially two shots in the final 9 minutes and one shot in the final 7.
Yeah.
Not sure exactly when that shot was. I didn't keep track of that, but they had 19 shots with about 7 minutes to go, and they finished with 20 on goal officially.
We talked about Michigan's depth defensemen having good games, Truscott being one of the main ones that thought was just almost perfect. The reason that he wasn't perfect was he got kind of lit up down the wall, and Luke Hughes is stuck in a 2-on-1. But Hughes ends up breaking it up as the pass kind of comes into his skates. It hits his skates and trickles back to Portillo, who freezes it. And that was, you could see Truscott did not have the momentum with his attacker, and the guy just sort of went right by him. And you're like, oh no, this was the borderline Blankenberg goal again. And this one did not get through. And that was really the last uh-oh for Michigan. I mean, you know, they had some time to kill towards the end, but you know, there wasn't really anything there. And then, you know, Stasny ends up probably making the save of the game, if you ask her, everyone, because Luke Hughes basically goes coast to coast with an empty net and is flipping it into the empty net. And Stasny sticks his stick out and just knocks it out of the air. Like, you got to be kidding. You can't even ice the game against these guys.
Yeah, that was a great play. I will say that Hughes, I think that was going to go in, but it was actually a pretty tough angle.
He was
pretty far to them. I mean, it was a backhand, and he didn't have much lane to get it. He probably would have still hit the post, the inside of the far post, and, you know, gotten it to go in. But that was not the easiest shot in the world. But still, just that stick comes out of nowhere and just slaps it away, and you're like, whoa. But then actually, if you remember, right after that, Hughes then just gets bulldozed into the net, and they had to do a face-off in the offensive zone, and the goalie had to come back in.
Yeah, which is probably more or less helpful, because then – like Notre Dame, you know, actually, you know, Michigan wins that faceoff, which I don't think they did, but then they even kill more time. The last thing of note before the game ends is, like, there's a dump in that Portillo catches with like 20 seconds left, and guys are kind of coming around him, but no Notre Dame player comes like directly to him. So he drops the puck and just plays it. And you and I both probably could, unfortunately, be audibly heard at, in the press box just screaming, "No, what are you doing?"
he definitely needed to freeze that. I don't know why he decided to keep the play alive with 20.
He hates faceoffs, man.
There are some times that he just needs to hang on to it. And that's, and they did, you know, after that happened, they passed it around. They wound it down to probably about 7 seconds. They took one last shot, and it was one of those heart stoppers, in part because it went wide of everything, but you see it not get saved and you're like, and then it just goes wide. And then Van Wy hacked it down the ice. They called icing and they put an extra second on the clock, but Beniers won the draw clean. So it didn't, you know, nothing happened. And that was it.
Yeah, and I think you touched on this at the beginning, and I think it's worth reiterating, but, you know, the team was so excited. Like, they mobbed the bench like they scored in overtime. I mean, guys just came off. Everybody, like, piled on Portillo. They came in with a huge group. James Collar got another great shot of that. But it was – I mean, it just felt like that in – it's a semifinal win and of a home game where you're, you know, better than the other team, so to speak, and – you know, but Michigan did not treat it that way. And that's sort of what this team needs, is because one of the things that has been stopping them all year is a bit of overconfidence, a bit of, hey, we're playing for more than just, you know, this particular game. You know, we're all here for those four games in March and that sort of thing. And, or April, I guess too, but they just, they played like underdogs almost, and they reacted like underdogs. And that, if they have that approach going into Minneapolis next weekend, and then, you know, into the tournament, like I said, Michigan plays like this, it's going to be really hard to beat them.
If they play like this, it's going to be 10-0 against American International.
If you find yourself in the penalty box in Ann Arbor or Metro Detroit, you want a Michigan man arguing your case. Call former prosecutor and now criminal defense attorney Jonathan Paul, the Michigan Law Grad, at 248-924-9458. Or visit his website at MichiganLawGrad.com.
Tough to have a more exciting game than what Michigan played against Notre Dame, but Penn State and Minnesota really gave a run at it, didn't they? I mean, we watched probably the first period at Yost. I was, you know, putting together the breakdown, and Minnesota goes up a goal, and then we kind of got back to start watching it, and they're up 2-0, and you're just like, well, there's not a ton else on, and, you know, it's partially our job, so we probably should continue to watch this game. And Penn State fought back, getting a goal and then a power play goal late in the second. And I mean, they gave Minnesota all they could handle, I thought.
Yeah, they got out to a little bit of a slow start. And then really about halfway through, Penn State turned it on and they get those two late goals in the second period to tie the game. And third period, I thought they were the better team for most of it, but didn't get anything past close. I mean, there weren't a lot of great looks in that period. And then suddenly there was just that little frenetic 30 or 45 seconds where they come down one way and get a chance. Minnesota does, and Penn State goes the other way. They get a chance, then they come back the other way,
yeah,
just trading rushes, and Minnesota finished it off with an easy just pass, and I think it was Sammy Walker that tapped it in untouched on the doorstep. So, you know, Minnesota, they're the better team overall, but they didn't play a very sharp game.
Well, and it kind of says something about Penn State too, because Penn State went to Ohio State and was down 1-0 in games and won the last two. And then they went to Minnesota and were down there and didn't quit and came back and tied it. And like you said, you know, they probably, I would say they were the better team aside from that one look in the final maybe 30 minutes of that game. And, you know, that's not really what we expected of Penn State in the second half. I mean, they played Michigan tough in the one game where Michigan kind of gave some stuff away. I think it was the Saturday game in January. But, I mean, they did lose to Michigan State.
I mean, Penn State,
it's not great, but yeah.
Penn State struggled to close games out, and they just couldn't get a save all year. Soulier was definitely better than Oscar Audio, and I wonder what it would have been like if he had played more games. I mean, 905 save percentage for him, but as a team, they had one of the 10 or 12 lowest save percentages in college hockey, and then you consider that they shot 7.8%. So not a winning combination there, but they're a scrappy team, and I think they're a squad that I would, if I'm Guy Gadowski, I'm hitting the portal really hard. And if I could find, I don't know, some 30-year-old goalie from the ECAC who has played four seasons at Holy Cross, and has like a 950, because they all do there. Obviously, it doesn't translate perfectly, but just to give you another body, because I've watched 2 years of Oscar Audio, and I just don't think it's happening.
No, Soulier definitely won that job and looked sort of the part down the stretch. I didn't, even on their collapse against Minnesota a few weeks ago, I didn't necessarily think they were really on him as much as, the defense that sort of splintered. And that was the thing is, this was trending to be a blowout. It's 2-0 and all the momentum. And, Penn State, they have like their tournament lives to play for, but they finished fifth in the conference. It wasn't like, they had there was a lot at stake with this team anymore, and they could have just folded, but they stuck with it, and Soulier stuck in the game, and it's at least something to build on. I don't know. It just sort of seemed like the game was over. I guess that I've said it about four times now. I just was, you'd like that game to be at home. I think we were also rooting for Penn State because you'd want that game to be at Yost. But, this is why we pushed all year, win the conference. Well, win your games and win the conference. You don't have to worry about that.
Well, the upside of it, too, is the pairwise implications, because by getting Minnesota, the way it shakes out, it looks very much like if Michigan is able to beat Minnesota, they will jump back into first in pairwise, which may not have been the case if you were playing at Penn State.
Yeah, and the only other note about that is that then, this is the only time Michigan has won the Big Ten tournament. It was actually in Minneapolis with the Connor team when they came back and scored late to tie and win the game in Minneapolis. So, maybe it's destiny, Alex.
Was that at the Mariucci, or was that at the XL Energy Center?
Well, I don't know that anything ever hit good has happened to Michigan at the XL Energy Center. So by default, I'm going with Mariucci. That was not the only conference tournament obviously going on. Not all of them are super relevant, but some of them do have some implications. One of them we can start with, Minnesota State, because that's a team that Michigan has been keeping their eye on as they're battling for the number one.
That was the XL Energy Center.
Oh, it was?
Yep.
So one good thing has happened to Michigan at the XL Energy Center. All right. Well, I guess I can't completely burn that place down then. But so Michigan's been kind of keeping their eye on Minnesota State just as they're kind of go back and forth. They made it through their weekend, and they'll play Bemidji this weekend after Bemidji knocked your personal rivals out of the tournament, Michigan Tech.
Yes, Tech is gone, and Bemidji, again, that also helps Michigan because Minnesota State does not get any real benefit from beating Bemidji, which kind of keeps them stationary, whereas Michigan can bank about as marquee of a win as you can get this weekend. So, and Bemidji, notable for the bid stealer implications. We're still monitoring that story. Didn't really get what we wanted last weekend because a lot of the chalk happened. Omaha was not able to pull through, and Quinnipiac still standing in the ECAC. But it's only about a 16% chance is what the KRATCH ratings have as the probability that Bemidji pulls that one off. But if they do, that bumps Ohio State out of the picture. So
yeah,
let's go Bemidji.
Beavers, if they beat Minnesota State, then does Michigan get the number one regardless, because their loss will obviously be to Minnesota?
Let me
Because that's I'm not sure that's kind that. Of an interesting I think thought. And that I believe that's a one gamer too, right? It's not that's not a series. Correct. That's
yeah,
a
no, that's one game.
Winner take all on next Saturday night, I believe. Probably on Flow Roller Hockey TV or whatever. It's $70 a month that you have to pay to get that subscription. But so we've talked some CCHA. The ECAC you and I spent a little bit of time watching this weekend is
I just ran the USCHO's pairwise predictor, which they published today. I just had all chalk in the other tournaments, and then I had Bemidji winning and Minnesota winning, and it has Michigan leapfrogging Minnesota State.
Okay, so...
So, under that condition, I don't know how other events, you know, if you...
Sure.
Oh, Lowell wins this one, and RIT wins, the, you know, I don't know how that all affects it, but probably.
So we were kind of paying attention to Quinnipiac just because, again, this is a bid stealer scenario. They were playing St. Lawrence and ended up winning their games. They're in the Final Four in, I believe that tournament is up in the Adirondacks, right? I believe they go up north to play.
I don't know where it is, but it's Quinnipiac.
Or Brooks Arena, Lake Placid. Yeah.
Yes. Quinnipiac is against Colgate and Harvard is against Clarkson.
Clarkson would be close to the hometown team there, but both of those teams are Quinnipiac is in and Clarkson is
not
on the fringes.
Clarkson can only get in as an auto bid because the only way they would climb pairwise enough to be an at large is by winning the games needed
by beating Quinnipiac
to get the auto bid. So,
yeah.
But that's obviously still the number one place the bid stealer could come from. To bump Ohio State out just because you have three teams there. Only one of them has to beat Quinnipiac to then let somebody in. I think ideally we would want probably Harvard or Colgate to be the one to do it. I mean, Clarkson's a pretty decent team. Not great, but they're decent. If it was someone really bad like Harvard, that would be nice.
Yeah, and over in Atlantic, which was supposedly going to get three teams in the tournament last year, according to our friend, it was USHO. There was somebody that wrote about
correct, yes.
their tournament is going to Utica. They have American International, who we all think is probably going to win it. They actually have a decent pairwise ranking. They're going to play Mercyhurst, who defeated Canisius, and then RIT plays Air Force. It's all kind of the same to a certain extent. Maybe American is a little better.
I would cheer for American to not win it. I mean, they're the favorites, but this is a single elimination thing. I mean, they, you know, that is far from locked in that they'd be the one. If you look at the KRATCH ratings again, let me pull these up. American is considered the best team there, but they're 27th out of 60 in KRATCH. But compare that to the other teams. So did we say RIT, Mercyhurst, and Air Force? Those teams are between 39 and 46. So American International is, according to KRATCH, a little bit better than MSU in Wisconsin, but worse than Penn State. Whereas those other three are only a little bit better than Niagara. And we saw so that's what we're dealing with there. I mean, this is just the case. Look, if Michigan gets the number one seed and they play any of those teams from the Atlantic Hockey and they lose that game, nothing to say. I mean, it's just you choked. End of story. Like, there's no scenario where losing to those teams is acceptable.
Yeah. Well, Michigan's lost to Air Force. It's a one seed before. And
someone in the comments just told me that. So,
and American International upset somebody a couple years ago, I believe.
Did they? I know Air Force did.
Air Force beat
St. Cloud the year Michigan went to the Frozen Four.
You're right. That's what it was. So as much as we want to see Atlantic Hockey, there are still a few PTSD moments that at least I get from watching this ridiculous tournament. But, and then over in sort of the teams that are a little bit better, supposedly in Hockey East, you have very few of like the old guard of what Boston U and BC, both those teams are out. Mass Lowell and Massachusetts will play. Massachusetts, obviously Michigan has seen. We think that aside from maybe their good goalie, Michigan matches up pretty well in that if they would draw them, they potentially could be Michigan's three. We'll get to that in a little bit. So you have, and then you have Northeastern and UConn in the other bracket. Personally, I'm rooting for UConn. Sorry, Craig. I know your alma mater is important to you, but we're trying to win a title here. And Northeastern has what a really good goalie that's been kind of one of those guys that you circle and you're like, you know what, if we could avoid one of these little bumps here, I would take it.
Yeah, Devon Levi, great goalie. Don't know why Canada didn't play him at the Olympics, especially when they had that other guy who was terrible. But
that other guy.
Yeah, I don't remember what his name was. He doesn't need to be named. The Hockey East teams are all about the same caliber. I mean, KRatch has UMass a little bit better than Northeastern and Lowell, but they're all in the same tier. We saw what UMass was. Northeastern scares you because of Levi, but, you know, they're only relevant really if Michigan loses to Minnesota and no bid stealer happens, because that's the scenario where Ohio State is in is 15, and then they have to be switched because you can't have an interconference matchup in the first round, which means that based on the way the probabilities break down, it would be one of them, probably Northeastern and Lowell. So I guess the hope is Northeastern wins some games and shoots up the board. I mean, Lowell is the one that's, I think, probably more favored to be 15, but all of that is averted if you get a bid stealer. So just cheer for Quinnipiac. And look, like you mentioned, UConn. If UConn pulls through, none of this matters because they're 15 in that scenario. Or 14 if Bemidji also wins. Or 13 if Quinnipiac goes down. So
this is why these weekends are fun, man. I've always like, it was a bummer when Michigan wasn't very good and you didn't get to like look into all this stuff. I guess maybe you and I approach this the way that the entire rest of the world approaches the Michigan basketball or the NCAA basketball tournament and who Michigan's going to face and where they're going to go. But I always get great fun out of the Hockey East and the ECAC and the Atlantic Hockey tournaments because they're just kind of interesting in terms of, you know, who gets those final bids in. And then this is where you don't wonder if someone's going to write their name on. It's pretty much set in stone in terms of,
well,
like,
and you look at the pairwise right now, we didn't really say this, but basically we know who the top 15 are going to be. The only scenario that changes that is the one where Clarkson rips off a bunch of wins and they jump Ohio State. Otherwise, these are going to be the top 15. It's just a matter of how many of those 15 get to go. Do all 15 get to go? Do only the top 14, only the top 13? Depends on what happens with the bid stealers. But there's really no intrigue in the bubble. You look at the pairwise probabilities, no one is jumping up unless they get an auto bid. So these are the teams, you know, Notre Dame, congratulations, you're in. No bubble worrying for any teams from 8 to 13, 14 until you get that point, and then you're worrying about the auto bid. Otherwise, everybody else is in. You know, Michigan Tech, congratulations. You know, here's your golden ticket.
That's big of you, Alex, from a personal standpoint. The only other conference tournament we haven't really touched on, the NCHC, and this is probably the one to watch.
It's the Frozen Face-Off.
Yes, at the XL Energy Center, which one day when they demolish it, they will let me push the button. But Denver plays Duluth and North Dakota plays Western. Both of these games will be on CBS College Sports at 5 o'clock and 8:30 on Friday night. So if you can manage to wrangle one of your three or four TVs away from the NCAA tournament, you can check these games out. Both should be pretty good games. I mean, all four of these teams are really good. Three of them are in the running for a one seed. If not, they're going to be a high two. And Duluth is just the scariest team.
Duluth could be a two as well. If they rip off a bunch of wins, they could get as high as sixth.
And they're just as scary a team once you get to the third period or later as maybe has ever existed. So all four, though, we were kind of hoping there would be an upset here or there from all the teams, but those teams are all really good and won their best of three.
We were cheering for Omaha, but that one, you know, didn't come to fruition, unfortunately.
So that's basically the conference tournaments, I should say, rundown. Is there anything in pairwise that you want to look at in terms? Last week we looked at some sort of the 7th to 12 range that Michigan is probably going to face. Obviously, they're not going to get anyone above 6. They could get maybe 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 in that range. Right now it's Quinnipiac, Notre Dame, Duluth, St. Cloud, and UMass. Obviously, St. Cloud is out. They're not going to move up from 10. Notre Dame is at 8, which is a little bit scary, honestly. If Michigan does get the 1 overall, Notre Dame could be either the 2 or the 3 if they're the 8-9, especially if Michigan goes to Allentown, because, you know, it kind of makes sense to send Notre Dame to Allentown because they're not too far, well, in theory, from there either.
It's like saying,
I mean, I don't know, man.
It's like saying Iron Mountain is not too far from Ann Arbor.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I mean, it's closer than Mount Whitney is, I guess. So,
yeah, Notre Dame, they are highly likely, about 80% probability to be either 8 or 9, which is not great. They have a 17% chance of climbing up to 7, but the pairwise predictor has not yet told me how I make that happen. It's some combination of Quinnipiac losing to Colgate and Duluth ripping off a bunch of wins in the NCHC so that you'd have Quinnipiac fall back and Duluth climb up. The thing I couldn't figure out how to make happen is how to get Notre Dame above Quinnipiac. They kept not doing that when I kept plugging in different results, but I don't know about that. Anyway, Duluth is likely to be in that range, but they have a lot of different chances to do different things. If they win the NCHC tournament, they're probably climbing up into the 2-seed range in the 7-5 slots. If they lose their first game, they're probably at 9, or I guess maybe 10. 10 is probably when UMass starts winning games. So I think there's a scenario where UMass wins the Hockey East and it's UMass Notre Dame in the 8-9 slots, or, you know, there's a lot of different options. What I can say is that if there's no bid stealer, Michigan isn't seeing, or sorry, if there is a bid stealer, Michigan isn't seeing Northeastern or UMass Lowell. They're not seeing Tech. Those teams are locked into that kind of like 11 to 14 range that doesn't really affect Michigan. So it's going to be UMass, St. Cloud, Duluth, Notre Dame, or Quinnipiac most likely. The nightmare scenario is NODAC loses their first game and tumbles into the 8-9 range. They have about a 25% chance of that happening. So from my standpoint, we want NODAC to do well.
Just to keep them high enough above sort of the potential Michigan slot.
I think probably we want Duluth to do well. But I think, aren't they playing against each other in the first game, or is it somebody?
No, they are not. Okay. Who's Duluth is playing? Denver, and okay. NODAC is playing Western.
Okay, that's right. So, yeah, we want Duluth and NODAC to meet in the title game, and we would like Quinnipiac to lose to Colgate. That's my assessment of the situation.
Because the teams in that...
And obviously, if Quinnipiac loses to Colgate, then the bid stealer happens and everything opens up.
I mean, the dream scenario there is you're probably not getting St. Cloud and UMass anymore. So you're probably looking at the best two options are maybe Quinnipiac and either St. Cloud or UMass. I mean,
probably, yes. I mean, K-Ratch thinks UMass is a tick below right now. There's kind of a tiers according to the K-Ratch ratings, right?
Yeah.
Minnesota State and Michigan are the same tier. Then there's Denver, Western, Minnesota, and NODAC. That's second tier.
Right.
Then there's Quinnipiac, Notre Dame, Duluth, and St. Cloud. That's third tier. And then there's Tech, UMass, OSU. That's the fourth tier. So if you can draw two from the third tier, you know, that's better than getting someone from the second tier, which is why we don't want North Dakota to fall. Problem is we just... let's just say are snake bitten about Notre Dame, and you, not me. I don't believe
some of us are older.
I don't believe in ghosts. I am not scared of Duluth because of the name. I'm fine playing them, but you are very scared. So,
man, I've seen some stuff. I'm just telling you, like, and we went through that last year, right? Where we looked at, we did the lineup of, okay, this looks like a game that if you took everybody's shirts off, it would get really awkward. So we'll keep everybody's shirts on. If you took everybody's jerseys off, then you would like, okay, well, I'm favoring Michigan. But then you look at like the overtime records and you look at like all of those little things. And you remember, like, they played, like, didn't Duluth play in like the most ridiculous college hockey game ever, like in the tournament last year against NODAC, where they went to like 49 overtimes or something? Like, I don't know, man. I think Michigan's probably better than Duluth.
They're definitely better than Duluth. We saw that. They played each other.
You're right. And maybe we can get someone to punch Nick Blankenberg in the head and get himself ejected and give us a major penalty again.
I found this out from my time in calling college baseball in the summer. Banana suits are really provocative from opposing teams. So we just need someone to wear a banana suit. Maybe Blankenberg himself in the warmups.
He seems like the guy that would enjoy that sort of thing. So he would just screwing with people's minds and having a good time. But anyway, so that's our non-assessment of this whole situation, because if you like this sort of thing, you're probably enjoying it. If you don't, you're probably fast forwarding through this
segment. This segment is basically just us at the pinball machine, just hitting the flippers as fast as possible and then just going back and forth. What I will say about this whole thing is, look, you know, go out there and beat Minnesota, get number one overall.
Yeah.
Draw some punching bag, take care of business against them. And then you're what? 65% to win your next game and go to the Frozen Four.
You think it's that high?
I mean, Michigan's 60% to beat Minnesota this weekend on the road. I would think against a third tier, according to K-Ratch, a third tier team in a neutral site is probably 65%.
What about against Notre Dame? What were they going in last weekend?
I don't have that off the top of my head.
Okay.
I would have to look that up. But my point is that if you get number one overall, doesn't matter who's in the middle tier, whether it's Duluth or Notre Dame, you are favored against them. And the number one thing that can happen in these tournaments is you have to win four games in a row that are dangerous.
Yeah.
Getting Atlantic Hockey is the closest thing possible to getting a game that isn't dangerous. Yep. So you get that game. If you can just get one coin flip to be not really a coin flip, then it's just, we go to the next round, 65% chance to go to the Frozen Four. That's all you got to do.
Yep. That's
correcting the record really quickly, because this was something that was an issue last week. We were spreading fake news, so we apologize about that. But the rule about host teams having to go to the site that they're hosting is a rule that doesn't come up that often, and it hasn't come up with a number one seed in like 10 years. But unfortunately, Denver is the host of the Loveland Regional, which means they have to go there if they're a one seed, and they're about an 85% chance to go to be a one seed. So if Minnesota State is a one, they probably ahead of Michigan, right? First overall, they probably get Allentown, and Michigan probably gets Albany. Whereas last week we were saying, regardless, Minnesota State gets Loveland and Michigan gets Allentown. That was not correct. So thank you to one of our readers who pointed that out, and we have corrected that.
If, in fact, Allentown is closer to Minnesota State than Albany, as they're both basically like the same distance east. I would say that
Allentown is probably far. I don't know.
Well, from Ann Arbor, I would say that it's more like an isosceles triangle, whereas from Minnesota State, this is the math section.
You got the atlas out and we're getting the ruler to measure the distances.
Minnesota State is a lot farther north.
The Minnesota State people, they don't have Google Maps, so they're out writing down which highways they need to use.
Somebody listening to this hockey cast is being like, is this what happens when Michigan only plays one game a week? Talking. All right. So we've beaten that to death. Very MGO blog of us. The last thing that we were just going to touch on is the thing we've touched on four times, and that is Michigan is playing Minnesota. So we'll go through some numbers and then we'll have some takes. Michigan, and I have Michigan's numbers, so I will say them both, and as so you can have a comparison here. But Michigan is second in pairwise, Minnesota is fourth. Michigan is fifth in Corsi, which has kind of been traditional for them since they've gotten some talent under Mel, as they've gone higher and higher up that chain. And Minnesota's 14th, which is not maybe as high as I would have expected given their talent, but Michigan's power play is 26%. Minnesota's is 19. Still both good. Michigan a little bit better. Penalty kills, Michigan's are 84%, and Minnesota's 86, so pretty much a coin flip there. Michigan has 12 drafted skaters. Minnesota has 14. Obviously, we know about Michigan's 7 first-round picks. Minnesota also has their share of really high-end picks as well. So the talent, I don't think, is much of a differential. And this is also where it's even, again, in skaters scoring over 0.75 points per game. Michigan has 7. Minnesota has 6. But Michigan does have 3 that are all over a point per game. And I believe Minnesota has 1, Faber maybe. And then the goaltending, weirdly, smaller sample size for Justin Close, but favors a little bit to Minnesota, as Close has a 9.33 and a 1.74, and Michigan's Eric Portillo has a 9.29 and a 2.03.
Look, Close has played really well. No question about that. Michigan's going to have to go out there and shoot high, especially yes. when he gets down on his knees or into the butterfly. Then there is room over his shoulders. That's going to be the objective. Putting pucks on net in general, making sure he's tested all the objectives. But look, we saw these two teams play each other in late January. Michigan was the better team that weekend. They didn't play a totally great game on Saturday, but Close was not stopping a beach ball early on. They got a big lead and were able to just kind of sit back in a shell and put the game away. And then that Friday game, Michigan played a great game in that one. Probably could have won it in regulation if Johnny Beecher had come close to hitting the empty net when he had a chance with about 7 minutes to go. And then we were denied a proper overtime because of the Triscott penalty. Just hit your chances. Don't hit them in the back when they're facing the ball. And do those two things, and Michigan's the better team. So you got to hope that they really want it the same way they really wanted this past weekend. I would think that they are a team that feels like they got robbed at the end of the regular season, and they're going to be out there ready to rock and roll. That's the hope.
Well, and the thing is, you know, once you get to the NCAA tournament, we just have seen how Plinko-y it can be. And you have one game now to hang a banner, and it's not the end banner that you want at the end of the season. And it's not even the regular season one that you're probably circled to begin with, but you have a chance to hang one this weekend. And Michigan has one Big Ten banner in, what is it, 7 or 8 seasons of competing in a conference tournament and in a regular season tournament, and they've got one. So here's a chance to double your total if you win on Saturday. That should be motivation enough. Playing Minnesota should be motivation enough. These have been the two best teams in this conference all year. They've more or less in ways split the season series 2-2, despite Michigan getting a point because one game went to overtime. So here's your game 5, and sucks it's on the road. You had a chance to keep it at home in end of February. You didn't. Well, the only time you've ever won a Big Ten banner is in Minneapolis anyway, so maybe they were doing you a favor.
Yeah, this is a big moment, and I think a lot of what happened at the end of the regular season can be redeemed if you win this game and you set yourself up strong for the tournament. So should be a good game. It'll be on Big Ten Network for regular people to watch. And
regular people.
We'll see what happens after that.
8 p.m., I believe, on Saturday night.
8 p.m., Posey Arena, but, I don't think that arena is too intimidating, frankly. So, we'll see what happens. Michigan just needs to play their game. Listening to Michigan HockeyCast 4.20 for Alex Drain and David Nasternak. Come back next week for our big bracketology hoopla episode.